Hi, this is Tony Roberts, and you're listening to WBAI in New York, the voice of truth since 1960.
On the count!
The U.S. prison system incarcerates approximately 2.5 million people, the highest number of any industrialized nation, while prisons remain the fastest growing industry in the country.
All my people up in Ray Brown.
Where you at?
All my people up in Spafford.
Where you at?
All my people in the group home.
Where you at?
Come on.
Where you at?
Come on.
Where you at?
All my people up in Morgan.
Where you at?
All my people up in B-Bay.
Where you at?
All my people in MCC.
Tell me it gets better in time. You say I'll pull myself together, pull it together, you'll be fine. Tell me what the hell do you know, what do you know? Tell me how the hell could you know? Hold your head up and be strong. 'Cause when you fall, you gotta get up. You gotta get up and move.
Till it happens.
till it happens to you, you don't know how I feel.
All my people inside and out, where you at? You're listening to 99.5 FM WBAI. This radio show is called On the Count, the Prison and Criminal Justice Report. You've been listening to the song by Lady Gaga entitled Till It Happens to You. And we think that that song is really consistent with our theme today of wrongful convictions. And until it happens to you, it'd be really difficult to understand what that feels like. But we do realize the tremendous amount of support people have for those who have been wrongfully convicted. For all of our people who remain behind the prison gates and walls, we really want to extend a generous and really strong and powerful shout out to each of you. And we encourage you to remain strong and continue to remain an activist in advocacy mode while inside and being an example of transformation to those who are around and among you. So we have a very exciting show today. We have two guests who will be joining us to talk about wrongful convictions. Before we get into that, I just really want to kind of preface our discussion today by talking about wrongful convictions in general. The United States, of course, incarcerates over 2 million people. And of that 2 million people, at least 1%, which seems like a small and insignificant number, has been wrongfully convicted. That 1% translates into about 20,000 people who are punished for crimes they didn't commit. On death row alone, 1 in 25 are likely innocent, according to a recent study. And when we think about it even more than 150 men and women in American prisons were exonerated in 2018, according to a recent report by a registry that tracks wrongful convictions. And, you know, combined, these individuals spent more than 1,600 years in prison, and which is a record for the database, which is dated back all the way to like 1989 or so. And some of the leading culprits behind wrongful convictions is, you know, innocent people who experience official misconduct, according to a report by the National Registry of Exonerations. And so when we talk about wrongful convictions, we realize that also false confessions have been involved in 300 of the more than 2,400 exonerations detailed in the National Registry of Exonerations. Here today to talk about wrongful convictions, we have two people on the line. We have Jeffrey and Bill. Are you there?
Yes, we are here.
Morning, Bill?
Andre.
Good to hear you guys. And so I really want to introduce each of you to talk about wrongful convictions. You each have been doing this work for some time. And I'll start by saying, Bill, you've been doing this work. You founded It Can Happen to You. Not the title of Lady Gaga's song, but certainly kind of consistent with that. You incorporated it in 2009 as a result of having been wrongfully convicted and prosecuted, and then subsequently exonerated after a rogue prosecution. And as the organization's chair and executive director, you built a coalition over the course of several years, doggedly and successfully advocating for legislation, creating the nation's first state commission on prosecutorial conduct, which was recently passed by the New York State Legislature and signed into law by the governor. It Could Happen to You also operates the Freedom Tour Speakers Bureau that features presenters who themselves have been wrongfully convicted, prosecuted, and later exonerated. And so I know, Bill, you've had a tremendous amount of experience in this work. And Jeffrey, you too have had a lot of experience in this work. And for our listening audience, Jeffrey Deskovich, MA and Juris Doctorate, he's an internationally recognized wrongful conviction expert. He's the founder of the Jeffrey Deskovich Foundation, the advisory board member of the It Can Happen to You Coalition, the global advisory committee member of Restorative Justice International. And Jeffrey was exonerated after 16 years in prison by DNA evidence. And so I want to jump right into it, people. I know that we don't have a lot of time, but I really want to get to some really pressing questions. I'll start with you first, Bill. You know, you've been in public policy reform for over 30, 40 years or so, both as an elected official and in private sector. What was unique on the campaign to pass legislation establishing the New York State Commission on Prosecutorial Conduct?
Well, there are two very unique features. One is the bipartisan political coalition that was formed within the New York State Legislature. And it was very unique in that the Senate sponsor was a upstate conservative, one of the more conservative members of the entire state legislature. And the assembly sponsor was a downstate, very liberal assembly person from Brooklyn. And I think that mirrors what's taking place in criminal justice reform across the country, is that it's the one issue that seems to bring together the left, the right, and the center. And when the final vote was taken in the Senate in June of 2018, virtually 90% of the senators from across the state, from all forms of political persuasion, black, white, conservative, liberal, female, Hispanic, Asian, all supported this bill. And the same thing happened in the assembly. The other thing that made this campaign unique and that makes the coalition unique is that we've engaged organizations that have not traditionally been involved in criminal justice reforms. We've brought in labor, we've brought in business, and we've brought in the exonerees. And Jeff has been very, very helpful in doing that because he can relate to the exonerees. And by the way, I was acquitted. I was not exonerated. Fortunately, I did not serve time in prison. It did cost I and my family $150,000 for that acquittal, and it involved getting a very good lawyer to combat the pervasive prosecutorial misconduct that the prosecutor attempted to get away with. Had she got away with it, I might be behind bars right now. But engaging the exonerees, okay, was important politically because there were exonerees from all across the state. So we were able to show that this, you know, this is not just New York City. And we were able to bring in exonerees of all color, okay, to combat the misconception that, you know, this is just a cancer in the minority community. It's a cancer in every community. And the exonerees get very passionate, and it's not only engaging them, but it's also a form of recovery for them and redemption. And so those were the two real political factors that, you know, I never experienced.
Sure. And Jeffrey, I know that, you know, you just graduated from law school. So congratulations to you. And you took the bar exam. And, you know, after 16 years of incarceration, you know, I guess, you know, you're wrongfully convicted. Talk to our listening audience about, like, you know, that motivation, right? Some people are, you know, they're completely dissatisfied with the system. They don't want to get involved, much less go to law school. So talk to us about that, Jeffrey.
Sure. So I make sense of the 16 years I did in prison wrongfully as believing that, you know, my place in the world is to fight wrongful conviction. You know, this is how I make sense of that in a kaleidoscopic type of way. And so, you know, that's why when I was exonerated and I was compensated, I started the Jeffrey Deskovic Foundation for Justice specifically to get other people home that are in the same position. So I've gotten 7 people home. We've done some stuff prevention-wise as far as videotaping interrogations, identification reform, DNA data bank. I met Bill about 7 or 8 years ago, and I hooked up with, you know, the foundation joined his It Can Happen to You coalition and became an advisory board member. And we've worked a lot together, and we got the Commission on Prosecutor Conduct and Discovery Reform passed. But getting to the heart of your question, Andre, is I got tired of sitting in the front row in the courtroom. even if I was the boss of the attorney, as in they were working for me formally, or if we were collaborating on a case, and, you know, and I couldn't, when we got to the courtroom, I couldn't sit at the defense table. I couldn't address the judge directly. And so to remedy that, I decided that having the master's degree with my thesis on wrongful conviction, that wasn't enough anymore. I needed the key so I could represent some of the clients myself. I wanted to sit at the table myself. And so based upon that, I decided to go to law school. It was hard. It was a three-year fight. You know, I think I worked twice as hard as anyone else. But at the end of the day, I graduated. And so I'm really grateful that the Elizabeth Hobbs School of Law at Pace University gave me the opportunity. And so that was why I went to law school. I graduated. I just took the bar. So I'm waiting to get the results. And so from there, a few minor steps left after that. That was the major thing, graduating in the bar. But at some point in November, in October, maybe November, I'll officially have the law license, and I'll be able to call myself a lawyer.
I see. And Bill, talk to us. Why do you really think that the New York State District Attorneys Association is opposing this commission with the lawsuit? What is their motive?
Hello?
Hello?
Yeah, I didn't hear Bill's answer.
I'm sorry, Andre. I got your question. The District Attorneys Association of the State of New York is, you know, a very strange breed. Because while district attorneys and prosecutors have the responsibility to correct injustice and to make rules and consequences, establish rules and consequences for injustice and bad behavior in society, they really don't want face any accountability or consequences when they break their own rules. And one would think that if, you know, why would you not want to take measures to prevent a tragedy such as a wrongful conviction? Why would you not want to look at measures to prevent people's liberty from being taken away from them, basically illegally? And we do it in other professions. I mean, in the healthcare world, we take measures to prevent cancer. But the district attorneys have made all sorts of really nonsense arguments over the course of the past years. They've argued that the so-called grievance committees work. We've been able to prove that they don't work. The Senate and the Assembly asked for evidence, cases that the grievance committees investigated. They produced nothing. In that sense, they lied because they told them that they would produce evidence. So what they're really afraid of, okay, the bottom line is this. They've never operated in a culture of transparent accountability. When the district attorneys run for re-election, they run on conviction rates. They run on high-profile convictions. Okay? This changes the nature of the political map for a district attorney. Because if the Commission on Prosecutorial Conduct finds some form of misconduct in, say, the Queens DA's office or the Monroe County DA's office, when those incumbent DAs run for re-election, their opponents are going to have a platform to run on. They're going to be able to point and say, explain to me why this case was reversed. Why did this particular assistant DA in your office was a serial violator of withholding Brady material discovery and you did nothing about it? Those are the types of questions that we need to raise in political campaigns, just like they were raised in Queens this past summer. So it changes the model for re-election. It creates consequences. Okay, a prosecutor could be suspended And by the way, every other profession on earth, give me a profession where there's no consequences when you break your own professional standards, whether you're an accountant, a doctor, even a chef in a restaurant.
Sure.
So,
and I wanted to get Jeffrey in. And, you know, Jeffrey, you know, you talked about the foundation, you know, having the Jeffrey Deskovich Foundation, having been part of supporting several people with getting exonerated. There's Andrew Kravick, that case, Jeffrey. Talk, and it was recently reversed. Talk to our listening audience about that.
Sure. So Andrew Kravick has been a client of the foundation for, you know, a while now. So long story short, the same polygraphist who framed me, who coerced a false confession out of me through the polygraph, Putnam County Sheriff's Investigator Daniel Stevens, did the same thing to Andrew Kravick. So here's a case in Putnam County. My case was in Westchester, but they drove me across county lines to deliver me into the hands of this polygraphist from the neighboring county. But, Andre, imagine a case where it's a co-defendant case, and one man is out. Anthony DiPippo is out. He's exonerated. He's listed in the National Registry of Exonerations. He's been compensated by the state of New York. And his co-defendant is still in, has been in for the last 3 years, despite Anthony being out. There's a mountain of evidence pointing to an alternative suspect, a serial rapist, whose MO was the same as in this case. Who was an original suspect, who the victim was last seen in his presence and with a red car in Connecticut plates, and that's the alternative suspect has a Connecticut car and with red car with Connecticut plates. Excuse me. So the conviction was recently overturned on the same grounds that Anthony's was, which was that all this evidence, Anthony had a right to present the evidence in front of a jury, which then found him not guilty. So my foundation had filed a post-conviction motion trying to overturn the conviction. That was denied. Then we went upstairs to the appellate division. They granted a hearing, went back down to the hearing. The conviction was overturned. However, the Putnam County DA, again in an example of misconduct and not wanting to admit the error like Bill was referencing, is appealing the decision now, and they got the court to deny bail. So while an appeal is pending, which is going to take about a year, you know, he has remained incarcerated despite his co-defendant being out for the past 3 years, despite all this evidence about an alternative suspect, despite the presence of the polygraphist who framed me, who I won a civil judgment against, despite him doing something very similar to him, he's remained in prison nonetheless.
Sure. And, you know, I think, you know, obviously, Bill, this is why you and others have worked to get legislation passed on establishing the New York State Commission on Prosecutorial Conduct. Bill, talk to our listening audience about the commission itself being supported by the governor and the Senate. Is that still the case? Are they still supporting it or not?
Yes. You know, the in the lawsuit, the DA's Association, you know, have been waging somewhat of a shameless PR campaign, okay, and leaking out things about the lawsuit and basically incorrect information. And this past summer, in one of the recent filings by the District Attorneys Association, and there's information being filed with the judge, they basically said that Senate and the governor were no longer defendants in the lawsuit. They just said, we're just going to take the assembly to court, and the lawsuit will be brought against the assembly. So they effectively removed the Senate and the governor. Basically, they said, you don't have to defend the commission. But the way they worded that publicly, okay, was that the governor and the senator, okay, the Senate president, came out and said, we're not defending the constitutionality of the commission anymore. So it was the reverse of how it actually occurred. All right, and that's very important. It's very important because the governor signed the bill. The bill is law. Okay, the commission is now law. Okay, and it's this misleading information campaign that they've, you know, continuously made all throughout this four-year campaign for a commission. And, you know, it's not needed. One of the cruelest arguments that they've made, that they made last year when the bill was on the governor's desk, was that, well, you know, we may make a mistake once in a while. Okay, and maybe somebody might be sent away. But that's a very small percentage. Most of them are guilty. Well, you know what? Tell that to the mother and the father and the sister and the daughter and the son of those who have not seen their father or their mother sitting at the dinner table for the past 20 years. It's a very cruel argument. Very unacceptable. So just to clarify where the commission is at, too, there's an agreement between the plaintiffs and the defendants, which is the DA's association and the state, the assembly, the Senate, and the governor. They had prior to beginning to make the appointments, the court will be given 45 days notice. Our position, the position of the assembly sponsor, Nick Perry, is that the governor, the speaker, and the president of the Senate should move ahead and begin to make those appointments. Give the 45 days notice, and those appointments should be in place by the end of the year. We are also working, and will be working this fall, with the Senate and the assembly to develop a budget proposal, which is already on paper, for the 2020 budget. And so the governor will actually receive some recommendations for staffing the commission with competent lawyers and investigators. This will be in the range of $3.5 to $4 million, is kind of what we've crafted out. Not, by the way, the 10 and 20 and 30 and 40, 50 million dollars that the DA's association is throwing out there to scare the public.
I see. And Jeffrey, you know, as we talked about different initiatives, with especially around this idea of it can happen to you, involved in New York, like, what are some of the deficiencies in the current New York law regarding videotape and interrogations? Because I know that that has also been at the root, oftentimes, of wrongful convictions, right? Interrogating people by way of video in some instances, and people not being able to stand against that and ultimately confessing when they obviously were not wrong. I mean, when obviously were not guilty of the very crime that they were alleged to have committed. Talk to us about that, Jeffrey.
Sure. So coerced false confessions have been the cause of wrongful conviction in 25% of the DNA-proven wrongful convictions. One of the remedies that has been proved out through, you know, experiments in social science to prevent wrongful convictions caused by coerced false confessions is videotaping interrogations from beginning to end. And the obvious reason why that's effective as a remedy is because the average person on the street does not believe that an innocent person would ever confess. And so, you know, in fact, there's an 80% conviction rate when there's a confession used as evidence. So videotaping makes it clear, is somebody threatened, is someone coerced, does a suspect, are they really giving non-public facts, or are the police telling them what to say and then presenting their testimony in court like, oh, he had knowledge, only a guilty party would, only a guilty person would possess. So based upon that, and this was the foundation's work, before, when we worked with other advocates, we were pushing to have video, you know, interrogations videotaped from beginning to end. And many years we worked on that. My case was one of the leading cases, and other cases of false confession also, recalling that mine cost me 16 years of my life. So anyway, pushing ahead, the bill that was ultimately passed came out watered down. It was supposed to be videotaping interrogation, any custodial interrogation from beginning to end. And what wound up being passed is that it's mandatory to videotape now, but there's exceptions. So, for example, if it's a second-degree murder, then it doesn't have to be recorded. So that law would not have helped me in my case because I was being interrogated on a second-degree murder, a felony murder. So exceptions for felony murder, exceptions for drug cases, exceptions for sex offenses. And so the obvious point to ask, obvious rhetorical question is, well, in what types of cases would it be acceptable if a videotaping interrogations prevents wrongful conviction caused by false confession? So in what cases would it be acceptable to have a wrongful conviction caused by a coerced false confession? Because apparently with the way the law came out, it'd be okay in a felony murder, it'd be okay in sex offenses, it'd be okay in drug cases. So it can happen to you. One of the ways we've been effective is just by narrowing the number of issues we work on at once. We support many things, but we only personally spearhead one, maybe two issues. And so we're about to turn our attention to videotaping interrogations to shore up those deficiencies. So
sure.
That's going to be what we're going to focus on next year.
Sure. And I just want to take a brief station break. You're listening to 99.5 FM WBAI. This radio show is called On the Count, the Prison and Criminal Justice Report. We're here in the mighty borough of Brooklyn, and I'm joined by phone with Jeffrey Deskovich and William C. Bostic, each of whom have been wrongfully convicted and subsequently exonerated. And we're talking about wrongful convictions. And so I had a question for Jeffrey, you and for Bill. I think that when we talk about what's happening in New York State, there are some other areas within the United States that we're curious to know about in terms of are other states doing better regarding prosecutorial misconduct, accountability, and exonerations?
No, they're doing, there are other, well, in terms of prosecutorial misconduct, we're the only state that has this measure in it, so no other state has it. So we've been in loose talk with other advocates and other legislatures just in the beginning exploratory phases to see what's possible and what's not. But Bill and I would love to have the commission exported into other states. So that's as far as that. In terms of where New York places, Texas is ahead of New York in terms of total number of exonerations. It's been Texas, Illinois, and New York is third. So we're in their company in terms of number of wrongful convictions. You know, there's been nationally, there's been per the National Register of Exonerations, there's been 2,481. Exonerations, but keep in mind that these are exonerations. These are people who made it out. You know, these are not the number of people. There's no way to count the number of people who have been wrongfully convicted. You can only identify them once they've been exonerated. You know, Bill and I have been looking at Pennsylvania in terms of they don't have exoneree compensation out there. They don't even expunge the record of people when they've been exonerated. There's been a lot of exonerations as of late. You know, just moving quickly, I don't want to be long in my answers. I know you have a lot of stuff to get to. Terrence Lewis, you know, was exonerated this year in Pennsylvania. He did 21 years. Hassan Bennett was exonerated this year. And these are all Pennsylvania cases.
Mm-hmm.
Hassan Bennett did 13 years. Clayton Thomas did 25 years. Sherman McCoy did 3 years. Mark Whitaker has done 17. James Frazier did 6 years. Dwayne Thorpe did 10 years. These are all just recent exonerations this year in Pennsylvania. All those people have been released with nothing, as happens in New York and across the country, but the difference is that they don't even have compensation in place. I was able to go to court, and after 5 long, hard years, I got some compensation that allowed me to get on my feet financially, which is partly why the educational opportunities I've had have come to me. But they don't even have that.
Sure.
So those are some issues that Bill and I, you know, have been meeting with elected officials, with some of those exonerees, with members of the legislature there, and we're in the beginning stages of putting coalition together to try to work on those issues over there. But clearly, prosecutorial misconduct and wrongful conviction is a problem in PA and across the country.
Bill, do you believe that? Yeah, Bill, go ahead. I'm sorry.
Well, I just wanted to pick up very briefly on what Jeff said. The mission of, it could happen to you, working in conjunction with Jeff's foundation, to have eventually a commission on prosecutorial conduct or a similar body in every state in the country. Okay, that's our vision. That's similar to what happened with the Commission on Judicial Conduct, which has been in place for about 45 years here in New York. New York was one of the first states to establish the Commission on Judicial Conduct, and other states follow. Okay, and I want to make the point that, you know, the governor and his tinkering around in court and in not standing up and making the appointments, and the senator and the Senate, when the governor signed this bill, he made it very clear that, you know, he was very proud that New York was the first in the nation to establish the Commission on Prosecutorial Conduct. But, you know, a message is that we are seeing broad political support and grassroots support in other states, such as Pennsylvania, and other states that I'm not going to mention right now for political reasons. But if we don't get moving here in New York with the appointments, we may not be the first.
Sure, I hear some feedback in the back. Bill, so I'm actually all the cut, like your radio's off, et cetera. And Bill, we have established and are working to keep in existence the commission here in New York State. Do you believe that the establishment of similar commissions in every state can really drive a movement for a new culture of accountability in criminal justice? I mean, certainly it must begin with the prosecutor, correct?
Yes. I mean, the prosecutor is where it all begins, where it all ends. That's the bottom line.
I want to piggyback, though. I want to say that there is a definite role that police play as well, because if they never arrest the wrong person, then the train doesn't pull out of the station. And to that effect, I just want to make clear that, you know, there's plenty of police misconduct that has led to these cases, from the unintentional, you know, as in ignoring clues, not being led by evidence, but instead, you know, forming a conclusion, working backwards with what they refer to as tunnel vision, to coercing confessions, to not doing lineups and identifications, you know, in a non-suggestive way, to not turning over, you know, Brady material, their police reports, material that could help someone's innocence. So there has been movement in New York as far as police corruption. In fact, when Bill and I were last at the legislature on the Puerto Rican, Black, Asian, Hispanic caucus, we spoke at a panel. We were on the prosecutorial misconduct side of the panel, but there were also other advocates there talking about police corruption, which would involve the issues I just referenced and on the wrongful conviction side, but also in court with concern of police brutality and unjustifiable deadly police force. So there is the police misconduct side of it. And, it can happen to you. We'll be looking at, what legislative initiatives we can spearhead. We're going to do something in terms of addressing the police misconduct, because that's another major aspect of this, along with forensic, you know, misconduct, another cause. But I'll leave that for something else I want to get into after with you.
Sure. Sure. And Bill, again, on the prosecutorial side, speak to our listening audience about that. And thank you, Jeffrey, for adding that front-end piece around police officers in and of themselves, because that's the first point of contact prior to even getting in before a prosecutor.
Let me pick up on the change in the culture of criminal justice, okay? there must be more of an adversarial relationship between the police and the prosecutor. That's the way the system was designed. So they would challenge one another. And instead of an adversarial relationship, it's developed into a cooperative relationship. And sometimes there's a hidden level of cooperation. Picking up on what Jeff said, in New York and in other communities across the state, there's been what's known as kind of their own form of don't ask, don't tell. So if the detective investigating the case comes across something that the defense lawyer may be able to use in a plea bargain or to completely exonerate or acquit his client, the detective will keep it in his pocket until the prosecutor says, well, is this out there? Is this out there? When in fact, the police should really be turning that over automatically. And the prosecutors, once they get it, and this is in the new discovery law, that it could happen to you. And the Just Foundation, we're very, very much involved in getting passed and signed by the governor this past March. That says that upon arrest, the police records must automatically be turned over. And 15 days after arraignment, everything that the prosecutors have got to be put into the hands of the defense lawyers. We have gone here in New York from one of the worst and most archaic discovery laws in the nation to one of the most progressive pieces of legislation. Now, the DAs have already stated that they don't like the law, but they're going to try and run circles around it, which is to be expected. And we're going to be watching them very, very carefully because the law takes effect January 1st.
That's also, Andre, the reason why, you know, it can happen to you. We first worked to get the Commission on Prosecutor Conduct passed before we then turned our attention to discovery, because that's what one of our bill sponsors, former Majority Leader Senator DeFrancisco, a conservative Republican from upstate New York, who had previously served as a defense attorney and a prosecutor. I mean, he said, look, you can have discovery reform is great, but if you don't have an enforcement vehicle, they're not following the law now. What makes you think that they're going to follow later? So that was the whole theory of getting the commission passed first as an enforcement vehicle, so that when there is a discovery violation, right, and we know that it's going to happen, there is something to hold them account instead of them continuing to get away with it like they've been. I mean, discovery was so terrible before that I had more rights, Andre, discovery, when I sued in federal court. So as a plaintiff litigating against the governmental officials, I had more discovery rights than what I did when I was a defendant defending myself against criminal charges.
Mm-hmm. So, Andre, one of the things that I think is driving the interest that we see in other states is that the average Joe gets the commission very easily, okay? It's just common sense. Wait a minute. If my son or daughter is cheated by a prosecutor, I want them held accountable. And most people, a lot of people think that there's already systems in place. Jeff and I found that while we were talking to Rotary Clubs and Kiwanis Clubs across New York State, educating people on the lack of accountability that prosecutors face when they cheat in the courtroom. And the average Joe thinks that, you know, there's something in place. They also think that if their son or daughter got arrested for shoplifting at a 7-Eleven or accused and it didn't really happen, they just, you know, pick up the phone, call the family attorney, they sit down, they meet with the prosecutor, and it'll all be said and done. That's not the way the system works. Mm-hmm. And the more and more people realize that, I always get the question is, well, why didn't you sue for the $150,000? It'll cost you and your family, and you can't sue a prosecutor. So there are no fiscal consequences. There are no punitive consequences. And there's nobody, I can virtually say this, that we talk to, whether it's a church group, a union, a businessman, that doesn't support the commission.
And Bill, you're coming across, Bill, sorry to interrupt you, you're coming across kind of low over the phone. I don't know if you can talk into more into the phone, okay. But it's coming across kind of low.
Yeah, I think I was holding it too close. But my point is that we haven't really met any public opposition to the commission from anybody. The only folks that have opposed the commission are the DAs.
Mm-hmm.
And what have they got to be afraid of? If they are doing their job, they should have nothing to be afraid of. And
sure.
Most prosecutors are doing their job.
Mm-hmm.
But there tend to be serial violators. And there needs to be that deterrent to taking away somebody's liberty when it should not be taken away.
So are you saying, Bill, that we can't sue a prosecutor? Is that specifically a New York thing?
No, that's a federal, a U.S. Supreme Court ruling. Jeff knows the details of that case, but no. There was a case that involved Thompson versus, actually it was the state of
Louisiana. The original case was Emler versus Patchman, but then that was affirmed in Thompson versus Connick, and in Thompson versus Connick, John Thompson, who did 18 years in prison, 14 of them on death row, and who at one point came within 30 days of being executed, who had evidence withheld against them, he sued the prosecutor, and he was able to also show in the course of that lawsuit that four other people had been wrongfully convicted in New Orleans and sent to death row on prosecutorial misconduct, being a cause of wrongful conviction. They were all exonerated, but the U.S. Supreme Court ruled that they have immunity. So you can't sue the prosecutor. The only way around that would be if they involved themselves in the investigation before an arrest happened. But after an arrest happens, they have complete immunity. So they could withhold evidence of my innocence, for example, which happened in real life, and you can't sue them. You know, I tried anyway, and the judge dismissed the prosecutor from my lawsuit on immunity grounds.
Sure. And Jeffrey, talk to us. I mean, we have a couple of minutes left. I really wanted to kind of get into, the idea of, in different boroughs, we've seen recent controversial elections around, people becoming DAs, et cetera, and particularly in different boroughs. What would you like to see happen in those instances for people being obviously elected and different kind of cultural controversial experiences? What are your thoughts?
Yeah, so in Queens, there was a recent election. So Tiffany Caban, who had been a public defender for about 10 years, she ran in an election, and she lost in a controversial election versus Melissa Katz. I mean, Caban initially declared victory, and then later votes were, these other votes that hadn't been counted suddenly, put Katz into the lead, and there followed a court action, and at some point it got dismissed, and Katz declared victory, and Caban conceded. So the Queens, that borough was very important because Queens is the worst borough of all of them in terms of documented instances of prosecutorial misconduct. So what's critical in Queens is that the new incumbent, having verbally said that she would do something in terms of criminal justice reform, wrongful mm-hmm. convictions, her having said it, I forget that she doesn't have anything in her background to support that, but she's claiming it, and we would like her to make good on that promise. We need her to get rid of these senior prosecutors in that office that have unleashed their reign of terror and have committed these misconduct. Masters is one of them, the lead prosecutor, a lot of other senior DAs. We don't want them to see them continue, because if they do, it's going to be more of the same. We want there to be a real conviction review unit. So in to give listeners an idea, when Ken Thompson became Brooklyn DA, 23 people were exonerated in 2.5 years.
Mm-hmm.
We want a similar union in Queens. So the former DA Brown, who passed recently, he claimed to have a unit, and while Brooklyn had 23 people exonerated, not one, zilch, zero, nada, nobody was exonerated through former DA Brown's unit. We want a real conviction review unit in Queens. There should be a supervisor who oversees it all, who's a defense lawyer, who is well-versed in wrongful conviction causes and reform. You know, we need at least 4 or 5 prosecutors and investigators assigned specifically to that unit, total with its own budget, transparent. We know who their names are. They're not doing anything else. They're just working on wrongful conviction cases. We need some exonerations there. What? There's no wrongful convictions in Queens?
Mm-hmm.
Of course there is, and we want the Queens DA's office to be proactive when it comes to supporting wrongful conviction measures that were, you know, that's being pushed in Albany to address known deficiencies that lead to wrongful conviction. And so anything short of those three elements, change in personnel, real conviction review unit, and support for measures designed to prevent wrongful conviction, anything less than that will show that it's going to continue to be business as same. So that's what our concern is there.
Sure,
and we're
sure.
hoping that DA Katz will do something in terms of that.
Sure. And lastly, lastly, because we're really short for time, and so I wanted to kind of connect the wrongful conviction and restorative justice work and see, like, what's the relationship between those two. We have, like, 2 minutes left. So, Jeffrey, if you can give us, like, 30 seconds or so of that, Bill, with some closing comments, and then we'll wrap up.
Sure. So I'm a member of Restorative Justice International, their Global Advisory Council. So the relationship is that restorative justice seeks to put people whole, back like they were prior to something happening, and to repair the void, that injuries that happen between people in the course of justice. So the relationship is that real victims don't want the wrong people convicted. Exonerees need to be restored also, and so it can apply to them, and also healing between victims and exonerees, because a lot of times the family go along with, they believe what law enforcement tells them, what is understandable. So for many years they may have, you know, hated or thought someone was guilty. And so to restore that relationship, you know, between people, to get rid of the hurt and feelings, that's the relationship between wrongful conviction and restorative justice.
Okay. Thanks so much, Jeffrey and Bill. And I know, you know, you use the term victims, et cetera, within restorative justice, just reflecting on the work of Danielle Sarid and the work she does with Common Justice and calling those who would be deemed victims as harm parties and the people that caused that harm as responsible parties. Just to throw those kind of, you know, those terms out there, which is really, really interesting. Bill, closing comments, 30 seconds or so.
Okay. Just very quickly, I just want to pick up on Queens once more, because that's really the, like Jeff said, the worst. And, you know, in that office, they have not only had misconduct, but they've defended their own misconduct, okay? So I just want to leave the public with this case, okay? In June of 2016, excuse me,
again,
July
we have 30, we have like 15 seconds left, Jeff. So, I mean, Bill.
Okay. The judge reversed a case on pervasive prosecutorial misconduct.
Mm-hmm.
When the Queens DA, Mr. Reibstein, was asked by the New York Law Journal about the judge's decision, his statement was, "I'm very surprised, because that was one of my cleaner closings." That's the arrogance. That's the flouting that DAs do, even in the face of misconduct.
Thank you so much, Jeffrey. Bill, we will have you back on the show as we continue our series on wrongful convictions, as we have other guests. I want to thank the entire On the Count staff for the amazing work we're doing to keep this radio show in existence, and by extension, WBAI, for allowing this radio program to exist. On behalf of all of us here at On the Count, we say don't give in, don't give out, don't give up. Stand tall in spite of it all, and stay on the count. And always remember, it can happen to you.
Till it happens to you, you don't know how I feel. How I feel.
Hi, this is Leonard Lopate, host of Leonard Lopate at Large, weekdays at 1 p.m. I want to encourage my listeners to become Lopate at Large and WBAI buddies. You can become a buddy, a sustaining BAI member, for as little as $10 a month. Please go to give2wbai.org or call 516-620-3602. And thank you.
On Sunday from 11 to 1 p.m. for Filibustered and Unfiltered, Part 6 of the Mueller Report, pages 227 through 276.
The president became very upset and directed his anger at Sessions. According to notes written by Hunt, the president said, quote, "This is terrible, Jeff. It's all because you recused. AG is supposed to be most important appointment. Kennedy appointed his brother. Obama appointed Holder. I appointed you, and you recused yourself."
That's Sunday from 11 to 1 p.m., Filibustered and Unfiltered, Part 6 of the Mueller Report, pages 227 through 276. This is WBAI New York.
Hey, what's going on? This is Tito Nieves. I want you all to know that I listen to Con Sabor Latino, Montuneando con Marisol, alternating Sundays from 3 to 6 on WBAI 99.5 FM or WBAI.org. Listen live. Also on archive when I miss the show. You know what I love about this show? They inform me about everything. Who recorded, who sang, who composed. And you know why shows like this, they're not around anymore. That's why they've been in existence for 34 years. And you know what? I like it like that all the time.
Why doesn't it come? Why doesn't it come?
Were you waiting for me, Dan Malley?
Who's that? Who spoke?
The Shadow.
The Shadow.
There isn't much time, Mally. They're coming after you to take you to the chair. Speak quickly. What have you to say?
Just this. For the best in old-time radio thrills, adventure, and comedy, tune in to the Golden Age of Radio, 7 to 9, Sunday nights, right here on WBAI New York.
Hi, this is Bobby Humphrey. You're listening to WBAI New York, 99.5 FM.